blanket and some sunblock. It's time for lying on the beach on camera. Lois and Steve.
Welcome to another edition of Lying on the Beach on Camera. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess.
And with our engineer,
David Nieves.
And we have an extra special guest today who's going to be talking about something that's very relevant right now. All the COVID rules are sort of being loosened up, despite the fact that some of the numbers are going up. And indoor dining is going to be something we're allowed to do. Whether we do it or not is another decision. And that's why we have Dr. Yaffe on with us, because he's going to talk to us about indoor dining. I want to tell you a little bit about Dr. Yaffe first up. It's Dr. Bruce Yaffe. He's a board certified in both internal medicine and gastroenterology. He is a concierge doctor affiliated with Lenox Hill Hospital and NYU Medical Center. He's been recognized as a Castle Connolly top doctor for over 10 years. And we really appreciate having you here and getting your insights on what we're all going through during this pandemic. So let's start off with the question we kind of teased in the beginning. Restaurants are now going to have indoor dining. A little while ago, wasn't the right thing to do. Now they say we can do it. Is it a smart move for folks to start eating indoors at restaurants, et cetera? What's your thoughts?
Well, first of all, turns out our medical office used to be a restaurant. So in essence, I've been practicing in an indoor restaurant for the last several months. And in fact, in February and March, before we knew what was going on in Manhattan, before the COVID pandemic struck, we were functioning in here, and several people, in fact, did get sick. And out of the 60 people in the office, only about 5 actually got COVID. So yes, it totally can spread through the air. And yes, we weren't wearing masks at that time. And yes, it is potentially dangerous. However, in New York, or at least in Manhattan, the epidemic spread rather quickly, as we all know. And in the 3-month period, I had about 45 COVID patients from February to May. And since May the 1st, I have not had a single COVID patient in my practice. And we've seen very, very few people have COVID in the city, quite honestly. It just seems like the way this disease spreads, it goes through a population, a local population, over a period of about 3 months. It happened that way in Wuhan, it happened that way in Italy and in France, and it happened that way, I think, in Manhattan. I think that many people actually are immune to the virus because we otherwise couldn't explain how people in nursing homes who are exposed both to workers and to sick patients. Not every single nursing home patient became positive or got sick. And we have to imagine that those people, especially the elderly people who are compromised in a nursing home, should be the first to get sick. So even if one person didn't get sick, how can we explain that? And I think that many adults seem to have immunity. And the question is it because of previous viral exposures? Or is it because of vaccines? We don't know the answer to that. But it seems quite obvious that some husbands get it, they sleep with their wives, the wives don't get it, and vice versa. So I'm imagining that a percentage of the population, maybe as high as 30%, actually is immune. And if 20% of the population has had it in Manhattan, or in New York City, I should say, that almost leads us towards a feeling of herd immunity. And I don't really think this has been addressed, because we don't see immunoglobulins, we don't see people who have positive antibodies, because antibodies go away. I've had one of our PAs in the office had a very bad case of COVID. She was hospitalized. She wound up donating her plasma. She had high antibody levels. And 6 weeks later, she no longer had antibody levels. Brings up an interesting question about vaccines also, which we can talk about, because vaccines basically stimulate antibody levels. But we've hardly had anybody in the world who's had this documented to occur twice. I believe there's one patient in China who was documented to have two cases. So it seems like there's T cell immunity as well as immunoglobulin immunity. And it seems like we should be measuring T cell immunity. And if we actually did do that, you might find that a larger percent of the population is immune than we originally could find just by looking for immunoglobulin immunity.
But we do see the numbers going back up, like in Israel and France and England. They were at a point where New York is now, and now they've climbed back up. So what explains that? The herd immunity isn't working there then.
I think that a lot of people have appropriately been protected. We stayed inside, we wore our masks, we avoided crowds. Of the protected people, I would say that it's a crapshoot. We still are, if we've been protected, theoretically, we're susceptible. I think what we're seeing now in the college communities, the kids under the age of 30 clearly don't have the same level of immunity that older adults might have. It seems to be spreading like wildfire in the younger communities. And admittedly, some people do get very sick, so we don't take it lightly, but most of the college infections aren't resulting in a lot of serious damage. Now, we don't know what the long-term effects of that are, so we do have to take it seriously.
But Dr. Yaffe, that is just the opposite of what everybody was saying. It was the older people that had to be concerned, and the younger people were immune.
Well, the younger people clearly aren't immune if it's spreading rapidly through colleges.
Right. And
I think kids, you know, it's pretty hard to be a college kid and to remain isolated in a college environment. But that being said, when the kids come back, let's say in Thanksgiving, to the parents who have been protected, I do think we're going to see some spike from that transition of kids bringing it back home. And I think that people who have, let's say a bus driver who in February and March was exposed on a daily basis, many bus drivers, many policemen, many frontline workers, many medical workers did get sick or at least became positive. I think the ones that didn't might be like the people in the nursing home who didn't. Maybe if a bus driver didn't get sick or didn't become positive back then, maybe they're the type of people who are immune because of exposures, previous exposures or previous vaccines or previous something.
Would you go to an indoor restaurant and eat now?
Well, I've been the equivalent of the bus driver who's been exposed. I was exposed to all of our workers here who were sick before we knew what was going on, before we were wearing masks in February and March, in what is in essence an indoor restaurant. This used to be Cafe Marimba before it was Yaffe, Rudin & Associates.
Right.
And in reality, I didn't get sick. I didn't test positive. So I don't want to be naive, but I think my chances of getting it because I didn't get it when closely exposed to people in my room for prolonged periods of time before we knew what was going on, I didn't get it. I didn't become positive.
So what would be your recommendation to people in the United States, you know, that want to start getting out and, you know, have the option of dining indoors?
I think that there's a certain risk. I think that in New York, we're talking about going to 25%. Outdoor dining has been magnificent. I think that with the outdoor wind currents, I think the chances of transmission are very slim. We have not seen a spike in New York. We're having an enormous amount of outdoor dining. I think that depending upon the level of air currents in an indoor dining environment, you could have a very stagnant environment. You could have people who are sick, and clearly in unprotected people, people who have been protected and who haven't had exposure and who are now newly exposed, there's a certain susceptibility. And I think that many of those people who have been reluctant to be exposed in the past are going to be the same people who are reluctant to go to a restaurant. I think that those who have either tested positive in the past or those who have been frontline workers who have not had any problem with COVID are going to feel very comfortable going to indoor restaurants. And I think that'll be a wonderful thing.
So let, to kind of summarize a little bit about what we're saying here. So like right now, you go inside of Macy's, you're wearing a mask, you're indoors, there are other people there, but your chances of getting something are decreased because you're wearing a mask, they're wearing a mask, and even though it's indoors, it's sort of a safe environment. The question is when you're inside a restaurant, when you don't have a mask on because you have to eat and drink, and there are others around you, your risk is significantly higher. Is that fair to say?
I think that the amount of virus in the air would be higher in a stagnant environment, in a room that was relatively small with poor ventilation, for sure. And people are talking, people are laughing, and it's going to, without masks on, it's going to increase the risk. However, again, I'm going to say if somebody has either had the virus before or has been a frontline worker and who hasn't gotten it, I think their chances are much less likely to get it in that same environment. That being said, there's studies in airplanes where you can actually, about 10 years ago, there was a study of a plane where a man had MERS, one of the earlier serious viral syndromes. And on that plane, they were able to document that five people got sick from that man being on the plane. And they were able to determine the airflow. And I believe that all the individuals who got sick from that person on that plane were in the two rows in front of him, and it coincided with the airflow. So in a restaurant, if you're sitting downwind from somebody who has the virus, you're more likely to get it than if you're sitting upwind. So the idea would be to sit with your back to the air conditioning.
Right. Have your back to the fan, so the fan right. or whatever is pushing exactly. away. That makes sense to me as well. But you mentioned the airplane, that situation. Were they wearing masks or no masks? I assume they weren't wearing masks on that airplane scenario.
I don't believe they were wearing masks. I don't think the man knew he had MERS at the time, and I think that it was...
Right. So, I mean, that's, you know, something else to consider. I mean, for me personally, I think at least in the short term and maybe beyond, I don't see myself doing any indoor dining because it seems like an unnecessary risk. I'm going to try and either outdoors or not eat out. You know, those are my two choices. But I think indoor dining, especially if you've been protecting yourself, I think right. seems like the right way to go. You're a different story because you've been dealing with people who have it and you haven't gotten it. I have a friend, like you mentioned, a couple, one person got it really bad, and the other person living in the same one-bedroom apartment didn't get it. So you have to assume something's happening there that protected that other person. So.
Correct. And I would think that they would feel comfortable in an indoor restaurant.
Yeah.
And I think that restaurants are not going to attract people like you who don't need to go to an indoor restaurant and who have been protected and who should continue to be protected.
So Dr. Yaffe,
until there's a vaccine, of course.
Where do you think we are now in terms of the virus? Do you think that that little by little it's going to fade out, or what is your prediction about the people you see? I mean, it's astonishing that since May you haven't seen anything. That's unbelievable.
I think that that we are preconditioned to be terrified of this virus by virtue of what we saw with the morgue trucks and the tents outside the hospitals in Italy. And I think that it is definitely a virus that kills 200,000 people. We obviously have to take it very seriously. But the fact that in, let's say, in New York City, despite the protests and the crowds in May and June, we still haven't seen a spike. And I think that it tends to run its course through a population, and some people get it, some people don't get it. But I bet that about 50% of the people are now immune, and that makes it less likely to be transmissible, except in circumstances where it's a new community. If it's a community that hasn't been hit yet, the whole thing starts over again for the next
time. So what can we do about these T cells? It sounds interesting that we should be taking another examination to see how vulnerable we are.
Well, I think that if we could do T cell evaluations instead of immunoglobulin evaluations, we could actually gain a lot of insight. And with tuberculosis, for instance, we do skin tests to determine if we have T cell immunity to TB. I don't think anybody's discussed that. I'm not an expert in the area, but it would be real interesting to see if somebody if there was a way to start looking for T cell immunity, which I think is possibly the more important immunity.
And tell us why.
Because once somebody has it, they don't seem to be able to get it again, even though their immunoglobulin level disappears over time.
Yeah.
There's only one documented case of a second infection that I'm aware of. Again, I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
I'm not an infectious disease person, but this has just been my clinical experience and my experience from looking at the literature.
And how do you take a T-cell test?
Like I say, in tuberculosis.
Blood?
No. In laboratories, in academic studies, I believe there are ways to determine T cell function. It's not something that we do clinically, so I do not know. You'd have to ask an infectious. You'd have to ask a researcher, quite honestly.
It does seem like public health should be investigating why some people aren't getting it. Like the case of a married couple where one person gets very, very sick and the other person living with them doesn't get very sick. You'd want to see, like, you know, look at their T cells. What are they eating? What are they drinking? And what makes that, how are they protected? If you get a bunch of them together and kind of do some sort of algorithm to see if there's some common factor.
Right. Or a nursing home person in an assisted living facility who doesn't get sick. It doesn't make sense. If it's a new virus, there shouldn't be immunity unless it cross reacts with something else.
So, you know, Dr. Fauci has said pretty recently that he expects another wave to come through here. We certainly are seeing it in Europe right now. The numbers are climbing back up, England, Israel, et cetera. So do you think that's going to happen here, or you really feel there is some sort of herd immunity and we'll be safe? I mean, there are problems in 35 other states, but New York seems to be safe right now.
I think, again, 50% of the population at least is susceptible. So if a bunch of kids come back from college and bring that, or if people from other states come, I mean, New York has kept itself pretty protected by its quarantine rules. But if people do bring it into the environment, and there are lots of people who have been protected by staying safe and wearing masks and not being exposed, those people, which is half of the population, would be able to have another spike. And I think that's what's happened in Israel and the places you just mentioned. And that a lot of that started when schools reopened, et cetera, and bars reopened in particular, because in a bar, you're really in close proximity to someone else. You're talking very loudly. There's often music playing, et cetera. Alcohol disinhibits people, et cetera. And bars, I think, are the classic example of where the virus spreads, especially since the demographics of bars is often the younger crowd.
That makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned the protest earlier. Any protests I've seen here in New York, I've been looking. Almost everybody's wearing a mask. They are outdoors. I mean, they do seem to be kind of respecting everybody's space in the ones I've seen going by here in Manhattan. I think we've covered the topic. Do you feel comfortable, Lois?
I feel terrific about it. It was great. Dr. Yaffe, as usual, was superb.
Can I also mention the ivermectin?
Sure.
Ivermectin is a parasite... anti-parasite medication. It's been around for 50 years. It's on the World Health Organization's list of 50 most important drugs. It's used for different parasitic infections throughout the world. In Bangladesh, for instance, I believe it costs about 5 cents per tablet. It's generically available. In March, in Australia, Monash University did a test tube study where they dripped ivermectin into a test tube of COVID virus, of the virus, coronavirus, and in fact were able to eliminate the virus by 99.9% in 48 hours in a test tube. On the basis of that, some countries, including Bangladesh and Dominican Republic, and now 34 other countries, started using that medication clinically because why not? It's safe, it's cheap, and in fact, some of the studies coming out of countries like Bangladesh report quote-unquote miraculous results when used early. In fact, the hypothesis is that ivermectin is able to block the ability of the virus to get to this part of the cell where it can reproduce, burst out of the cell, and multiply. There's a protein that has to carry the virus to the ribosomes where the actual virus multiplies. And apparently ivermectin, according to Monash University, is able to block the ability of the virus to link to that carrier protein. And in reality, if in fact that works, it prevents the virus from reproducing. And if we can prevent it from reproducing by catching it early before it's widespread in the body, the immune system has a much better chance of knocking it out. Well, because in a test tube, the concentration was much higher than you can get in the human body, a lot of researchers just dismissed it out of hand. But in reality, countries like Dominican Republic and Bangladesh, where there were no other options, when a sick person came to the clinic, they gave them ivermectin, sometimes with doxycycline, and in fact reported remarkable results. It is surprising to me that in spite of this, there has not been a lot of academic research about it in the United States. And the consequence is nobody is really wanting to write about something like this because of the hydroxychloroquine political situation. Until there's an academic study, it would not be prudent to be writing about this. However, Monash University now is doing active research on it. And in fact, there's reason to believe that they're giving it to their frontline medical workers preventatively once a week with some success. And I think that it would be interesting to look into that to try to figure out, A, if it's academically on the verge of approval in Monash University, which is the Harvard equivalent of the Australian Harvard, let's say, in which case it would give it academic credibility. And B, why isn't there academic research about something that seems quote unquote miraculous in Bangladesh? Why isn't
that being done? So you tell us the answer. Why? You tell us.
I do not know. I've discussed this with different people at different universities, and I have not gotten an answer as to why no one is, I haven't seen academic research on a $5 or 5 cent drug. It's $5 per pill.
We will bring it to the attention of all the medical writers, lifestyle and stuff like that.
And I think the fact that you're mentioning it now is just one more. I mean, the more people talk about it, the more people that will ask for it and look for it. And so I think there's something to be said just talking about it.
I think it's premature necessarily to ask for it as a therapy.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah.
I think it is appropriate to wonder if, in fact, academic research is going to verify that this is an effective therapy if caught early, along the lines of Tamiflu. Tamiflu works if it's given in the first 48 hours of the flu before the virus has a chance to multiply.
Say the name of the drug again, one more time.
Yeah, I want him to spell it. He's got to spell it for us.
Ivermectin is I-V-E-R-M-E-C-T-I-N, ivermectin.
Okay.
We'll put that
readily available
on the screen.
What?
It's readily available. It's used in veterinary medicine, and it's safe. And I just would love to understand if it is a valuable drug, because other countries seem to think it is. I believe it's approved in 34 other countries now for use in COVID.
We will be looking into it. Strange Absolutely. For us to be coming back to you, but okay.
Bruce, thank you very much. We appreciate your expertise, and hopefully our viewers
this has been wonderful.
Absolutely. And viewers, if you like this kind of podcast, please click on subscribe. We could always use more subscribers. And like this, of course. And we'll be back next time with something else. But once again, Bruce Yaffe, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. David, as always. And I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess.
And we have been Lying on the Beach. So long.
Bye. Bye-bye.